Do keep that passage open in front of you. It would be a great help to me and I'm sure to you. And on the back of the piece of paper you were handed on the way in, you'll find an outline for where we're going in our time together. During this month of January, we've been looking at the greatest investment we can ever make. We're a city full of investors. We invest every moment of every day. We're always investing to this end or to that end. And we've been looking at how we can make the greatest investment ever. We've been thinking about how we can invest for life, for real life, lives that are purposeful, lives that are lasting, lives that are peaceful in the true sense of the word, lives that, again, in the true sense, are genuinely happy. We've seen that we do that by God stirring us up, God empowering us to live with His priorities and His agenda at the heart of all that we're about. That we do it by giving all that we are and all that we have. Not to build a physical temple like the people in Haggai's day, but to build up God's people today, God's church. I wonder if you've ever come across the phrase, only one life, 'twill soon be past, only what's done for Christ will last. It's a phrase that I've often had as a screensaver on my computer, and until the other day I never realised how it continued. The poem continues like this, and when I am dying, how happy I'll be if the lamp of my life has been burnt out for thee. It's a great picture, isn't it? A great picture of someone living for God's priorities, being stirred up to live for God, to invest their all for God. It'd be a great sort of summary of Haggai. And yet, if you're anything like me, we go through the weekend, all those best intentions can be crowded out by busyness, distractions, and so on. So I wonder how you found Haggai. I've found myself repeatedly asking the question, what would this look like for me? But over the last week, I've been asking a different question. What would it look like if we were all to do this? What would it look like if 2007 was to become in the city a year of God-empowered, God-glorifying church building? If we began to pray for our colleagues, if we sought to speak to just one person in the office about Jesus, what would that look like? What would it look like if for next week we all sought to ask just one person for next Thursday? Wouldn't that look great? Or if we all called one Christian we hadn't seen around for a while to see how they're getting on, to have a coffee? What would be the result of that? Wouldn't it be great? Well, the shock is that the Bible says for many of us, it would be far from great. It would lead to opposition. It would lead to our lives getting tougher. And that's often why we avoid doing it. Churches in Manchester recently carried out a survey. They asked people who wouldn't call themselves Christians, would they go to something at church if invited to go by a friend? Do you want to know the result? 80% said they would go if asked. In the same survey, they asked people who call themselves Christians how many would invite their friends to hear a talk about Jesus. The result? 70% said no. They wouldn't ask them because they thought they'd refuse. Is that not a staggering statistic? You see, often the problem isn't with our friends, it's with us. We won't talk to them about Jesus. We won't invite them to meetings. I assume that my friends are in the 20%. Do you do that? The 20% who are hard and difficult and would say no and would reject me as a consequence, and so I don't bother. I wonder if you can relate to that. Well, today as we come to the last part of Haggai chapter 2, well, it's a situation that God's people and their leaders could definitely relate to. Again, date is the key. The date for the third and fourth sermons of Haggai is the 18th of December, 520 BC. They'd been rebuilding the temple now for 3 months, but they could be forgiven for feeling a sense of déjà vu. They'd been here before. 16 years previously, they'd made a good start, and then opposition had arisen, and the work had faltered. It has ground to a halt. You see, they could be forgiven for feeling anxious. And yet I guess for many of them, there would have also been a great sense of excitement. December's the time of year there where the early rains fall. They've ploughed the fields, they've sown the seed, and the rains fall. And they're just wondering, perhaps, will this be the year that the hosepipe bans end and the good harvests return? After all the work we've put in over the last few months, surely things can only get better. And that takes us to our first point. Don't presume on God's gracious blessing. It's a simple but striking point. And Haggai makes it in two ways in verses 10 to 19. First, he poses some quick fire questions. Verse 11, it's the priest's specialist subject. They're the legal experts of their day. Verse 12, question 1. If someone carries holy meat in the fold of his garment and touches with his fold bread or stew or wine or oil or any kind of food, does it become holy? I don't know what you know about the Old Testament priests. They were allowed to keep a portion of the sacrifices that they offered, a goat or a lamb. They were allowed to keep a part of it and take it home for themselves. I guess it's a bit like when you and I carve the Sunday joint, isn't it? The carver is always allowed his own slice. It's one of the perks of doing the job. Well, the priest would have wrapped up his piece of lamb in his robe and headed home, but he may have decided to pop into M&S on the way home and get something to go with it, a nice green salad or some red currant jelly or something. Now, here's the question. Just because the meat's holy, does it mean that everything that comes into contact with it, however indirectly, would become holy too? You see, Haggai's asking the priests the question that GPs up and down the land get asked every day of the week. Is it contagious? Verse 12, is holiness contagious? Verse 13, is unholiness, uncleanness contagious? Well, these legal experts aren't like their modern counterparts. They don't charge by the word. Look at their answers. Verse 12, is holiness contagious? No. But notice verse 13, unholiness is contagious. It is catching. It's the same with sickness and disease, I guess, isn't it? That colleague comes into the office full of cold, infects the rest of the team. But if you or I were healthy and wandered down the road to Bart's hospital, we couldn't stroll through the wards, suddenly making everyone well again. It's not the way sickness works, and it's not the way holiness works either. Well, full marks for the priest so far. But do you notice that God seems harder to please than most quiz show hosts? Do you see his punchline in verse 14? So it is with this people, not my people. So it is with this people and with this nation before me, declares the Lord. And so with every work of their hands. And what they offer is unclean. It's a savage put down. The people are unclean. It's a throwback to chapter 1. Haggai seems to be deliberately echoing what we saw a couple of weeks ago. God's people had made poor investment decisions. We saw that they didn't put God first. They didn't work for his glory. And we saw then that the impact on the nation's life was disastrous. But imagine now, months later, as the people hear that again, what they must have been thinking. Hang on a minute, Haggai. Yes, hands up, we made poor investment decisions. But like any good fund manager, we'd realised that. And we changed our investment strategy. We've been working hard now for months. But do you see what Haggai is saying? Holiness isn't contagious. Don't think your obedience makes you clean. It won't get you into God's good books. Don't presume on God's blessing. And just in case they don't get the point, Haggai puts it a different way. Verse 15, he gives them an observation test. Three times in verses 15 to 19, he calls them to consider something. Literally, to get hold of their minds. Haggai is wanting them to be like many of you, I guess. Day in, day out, you have to analyze things. He's saying, analyze this. Look around at what you see. Verse 15, think back to what life was like before you'd laid the foundations of the temple. Compare it to life today. Verse 16, consider how little you have and ask the question, why? You see, the shortages weren't just some freak anomaly. Verse 17, the blight, the mildew and the hail, they weren't just a blip in the market. It wasn't just a bearish day in an otherwise bull run. No, the people were meant to realize, verse 17, that God was striking them. It's God who's sending the blight, the mildew and the hail. It's God who's sending the very things he'd promised back in earlier parts of the Old Testament that would be curses for disobedience. He's still sending them. But the people were still under God's judgment, even though they'd started working again. And verse 19, notice there's no escape. There's no seed in the barn. There's no seed to plant. There'll be no crops to harvest. There'll be no hope of a decent meal. Do we get the point? Even after the people had been working on the temple for months, the blessings hadn't materialized. Why? Because God's blessing isn't earned. It's not triggered by one act of obedience. It's not conjured out of God by some magic formula like in Harry Potter, as if God is some celestial slot machine whose arm just needs to be twisted to release the goodies. Our failure to put God first, it puts us into God's bad books. But I mustn't think that one good deed will undo all of that. It's what God's people in Haggai's day struggle to grasp. It's what the religious leaders in Jesus' day struggle to grasp too. They thought that all of their religious acts would get them out of God's bad books and into God's good books. If for those who are in the partnership, this week we're looking at Mark chapter 7 and we've seen that the problem people face isn't something that's external. It's internal. We've all got hearts that are unclean and rebellious. The New Testament makes it clear that God's blessings only flow because of Jesus. Jesus, who as he dies on the cross, begins to build a new temple, a new people. And the blessings flow only to those who come to Jesus for cleansing and for life. God's blessing comes at the word of God and at the timing of God, not because of our obedience of God. You might be here today just looking into Christian things. It's great that you're here. But do please see what Haggai's saying to you. Two things. First, he's saying, you cannot catch holiness. So as you and I stand before God on that last day in judgment, we cannot play the Christian parents card, or the Christian husband or wife card, the Christian children card. We can't play the I used to go along to church card, or I've been through the church rituals card, as if somehow we can do something that triggers God's blessing. We cannot catch holiness. And secondly, please notice, there is no escape. Going our own way in God's world means we're hopelessly cut off from God. And that means we're cut off from the life that he offers. And nothing that you and I do can get us into God's good books. One of you was telling me the other day about the new diversity forum in your bank and how it discusses issues like meritocracy in the workplace. It's great to have discussions like that, I guess. But please notice Haggai is saying here that there is no meritocracy with God. There's no earning our way into God's good books. Many of us here today will call ourselves Christians, and I hope that during January we've heard God's call to invest in life this year, to make 2007 the year where we get involved in building up God's people here in the city. But there is a danger as we'll do that. And the danger is that we presume upon God's blessing. We can do it individually. I can think, I've done that evangelism training course. Surely now all the office will become Christians. You can do it as you begin to pray for your office. We can do it as we go back from today and share something of what we've heard with colleagues. We can think, just because I've done something, there's just that danger, isn't there? That I think some of this will trigger God's blessing or earn God's favour. If we can do it individually, I guess it's easy for us to fall into that trap corporately. Take next week. We've got a cracking venue here in the heart of the city, a barn of a building that we could fill easily. Got a good speaker. Philip is very clear and compelling. But there is just the danger that we'll take God for granted, that we'll think he owes us one, that we deserve a big crowd, that we deserve lots of people signing up to find out more afterwards. No, says God. We mustn't be tempted to think like that, to presume that our service of God somehow puts us in our debt. Yesterday evening I was looking again at Robert Murray McShane's glorious hymn, "When I stand before the throne, dressed in beauty not my own, when I see thee as thou art, love thee with an unsinning heart, then, Lord, shall I fully know, not till then, how much I owe." God is sovereign in choosing to bless. And I take it that's what makes the end of verse 19 so striking. Do you see it? God simply says, from this day on, I will bless you. His sovereign grace comes out of left field, as it were. It comes out of nowhere. Of 9 verses on uncleanness, on cursing, and then God simply says, I will bless you. No way out. And then suddenly, the great escape. God will intervene. God will act to set his people free. And that takes us to his last words in verses 20 to 23. Do pine for God's glorious future. It looks, verse 20, as if it's a sermon for one man, for Zerubbabel, but it's also a strong encouragement for all who work for God's glory now. Verse 21, speak to Zerubbabel, governor of Judah, saying, I'm about to shake the heavens and the earth, and to overthrow the throne of kingdoms. Remember, they'd have needed to hear those words. Remember that any excitement they'd have felt about the temple being rebuilt would have been tinged with that anxiety and apprehension, wondering whether opposition is going to occur again, wondering whether it's all going to come to nothing yet again. One of you told me last week how challenged you'd been by Haggai to be flat out for God this year. It was a great encouragement. But I was equally encouraged by your honesty when you said that you were anxious. Because what would happen if you did speak to your colleagues about Jesus? What would happen if you did seek to encourage and spur on your Christian friends? Haggai's words in these last few verses are a great encouragement to us to stick at it, to keep working for God's glory. First, he tells us about the ultimate crash. Verse 21, there will be a day when God will shake the world. On that day, only things of God's kingdom will stand. Only investments made for God's glory will survive. All other investments, that car, that house, those clothes, whatever it is, they'll come to nothing. Verse 22, it'll be a day when God's enemies are reduced to nothing by the power of God. It'll be a day when governments go to the cupboard, pull out their emergency disaster scenario, and find that it's totally inadequate. God will destroy dictators. He'll overthrow military superpowers. He will tear down all forces in opposition to his rule. I listened this morning to the Secretary of State for Education talking about these equality regulations. So sure that he would have the last word. He won't have the last word, will he? God will tear down all forces in opposition to his rule. And verse 23, on that day, notice, God says he will take Zerubbabel and choose him to be his signet ring, his seal of office, his representative, his chosen king with his authority to rule his world. It's a staggering promise. The last king of Judah, Zerubbabel's grandfather, had been thrown off like a signet ring by God at the time of the exile. And here God is promising that he hasn't given up on that line of kings. The kings promised to David, he hasn't given up on them. But if you and I were to go and pull down the history book and look at the history of Zerubbabel's reign, we'd see he was a great leader. But we wouldn't see verses 20 to 23 happening. And we wouldn't see pagan powers collapsing. We wouldn't see him establishing a worldwide eternal reign. No, we end Haggai, and we end the Old Testament longing, pining for this ultimate king. And we start the New Testament in the Gospel of Matthew, looking at Jesus' family tree, where we see that Jesus is not just a descendant of David, but we see that he's a descendant of Zerubbabel too. We come to the end of Matthew's Gospel, and we hear the risen Jesus calling God's people to go and make disciples of all nations, to get on with building God's church, knowing that he's with them, knowing that he's strengthening them for the task. Do you see how this should encourage Zerubbabel? How it should encourage you and me as we put our hands to the plow this year and seek to work for God's glory. You can see it in church history. We can see it in the 20th century in countries like Cambodia and China and Russia, where God's people, strengthened by him, looking to the future, realize opposition cannot stop God's kingdom being built. But we can also see it in the everyday task of building God's church. 3 years ago next week, I went to Cambridge to help with a week's outreach. I spoke in a college on the first night. The Christians had been very brave. They invited a crowd of people to come and hear me speak. It all went well until the question time, which was hijacked by one really vociferous bloke. People couldn't get a word in, and it was really frustrating because there were a few people beforehand and during the talk who seemed genuinely interested. One guy, Tom, in particular. Before the talk, he'd said he was going to go and hear Philip Jensen the next night. Philip was the main speaker of the week, and we arranged to meet. But I stood outside the big meeting room the next night, slightly fearful that he wouldn't show, that he'd have been put off. I needn't have been. He showed up. He said he hadn't been put off by the difficult person. And at the end of that talk that night, he turned to me and said, "Are you coming tomorrow?" It was a great encouragement. He came the next night and the next one. Every night that week he came and listened as the gospel was explained. And then on the last afternoon that I was in Cambridge, we had coffee together, and I looked at him and said, "Tom, have you seen that you've rebelled against God and you're utterly lost without Jesus?" "Yes, I do," he said. "Do you want to do something about it? Do you want to ask for God's forgiveness and make a fresh start with God?" "Yes, I do," he said. So right then and there at a table in Cafe Nero, I prayed and then Tom prayed. And God's church grew by one person. There's no better investment I could have made that week than spending time with Tom. God's blessing will come. God's blessing will come when he sovereignly and graciously chooses, and it will be utterly glorious. It won't be easy, but God tells us he'll be with us in the present, and God tells us he'll win in the end. So stick at it. Here are two questions for us to think about round our tables. We spent 3 weeks in Haggai. Question one, in what areas do we need to hear Haggai's challenge to put God first and live for him? In what areas of our lives do we need to hear Haggai's challenge? And then question two, where do we need to hear Haggai's encouragements? Got that? Spend some time discussing those round our table, and then we'll come back and I'll pray at the end.